Well, we were a little disappointed this afternoon. Our 28-year-old son was over, and we said, so you're not coming to Sanctuary to hear your mom and dad talk about marriage and sex? Just kind of rolled his eyes.
Already heard it.
Drove away. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. So we're going to talk about marriage and sex tonight, but we thought it might be an interesting way to start. I'm sure some of you have heard, but we'd like to tell you the story of how we met, wouldn't we?
Fire away.
Here we go.
Yeah.
So I'm going to start, and John will provide color commentary. So we met on a blind date, a long time ago, and it was right after I was coming off of a very long, intense relationship that I had broken up, but even when you're the one that breaks up, it still sucks, and I was not interested in going on a blind date. So my best friend from high school called me and said she and her husband were going to be coming out from Illinois into the LA area. He was going to be speaking at a college gathering for their church, Backyard Barbecue, and John was on staff at the church going through Fuller, and they wanted me to meet him, and I said, not going to happen. I'm moving to Chicago in 3 weeks to finish grad school back there. Just came off this relationship, not interested. And been on 3 blind dates before. Came back from the 3rd one, fell to the ground, kissed the ground, thanked God I was home, swore them off. Never again. Never again. You know. So then she said,
and that was me. So
No, it wasn't. No. So then she said, well, he's all that. And she started telling me how great he was. And I said, this is perfect. This is not a guy that's going to have a hard time finding a date. It's not going to be me. So then she said, with a 3rd attack, I'm only going to be out for 2 nights. The 2nd night I'm seeing my family. If you don't come to this event, I won't get to see you. So we crossed the line from blind date, right, into emotional blackmail. So I reluctantly agreed to go, fell asleep on the date, but only for a little while, not for very long.
And that had happened to me often, so,
so John was used to it.
Take that as a bad sign at all.
Yeah, he just thought I was very relaxed, but actually I was just tired. And
tired and a little bit bored.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. And honestly, had it not been for the last 10 minutes of the date, if he had called back, I would have said no. But the last 10 minutes, pretty good. Pretty good.
We were making out.
No. No, I am an absolutely no kiss on the first date girl. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's what do you mean you are?
That's
a
creepy.
No kiss
yeah,
on the
I still hold to that
girl.
To this day. I still go by that. It's, yeah.
So.
Yeah.
So this is back before their cell phones, and we'd had the first date, and I didn't seem real suave to say, hey, baby, give me your number, and the couple that introduced us, didn't seem real suave.
Baby.
Yeah. So the only way I knew to get in touch with Nancy after that date, if I wanted to ask her out again, was I knew that she attended this church in Southern California, Whittier area, and I was working on staff at a church in La Crescenta, California, and so I called the church up and said, my name's John Ortberg, I'm a pastor at First Baptist Church, La Crescenta, and I need the phone number of one of your parishioners named Nancy Berg. It's kind of a ministry thing. And the receptionist put me on hold and didn't come back for like 5 minutes, literally. And finally she came back and gave me Nancy's number. And what she didn't tell me, and I didn't find out for another 6 months, was the receptionist at that church was Nancy's mother, Verna Berg. And she actually put me on hold and called Nancy and said, there's some guy,
who is
he says
this guy?
He's a pastor and he wants your phone number. Fortunately,
I said,
Nancy
yeah,
said,
yeah, okay, you can give him my number. Yeah. So we went out 2 more times, and then I moved to Chicago, and I spent 2 semesters in Chicago, and winter hit, and I said, what pioneer stopped their wagon in this city and said, let's not go any further, get me out of here. I came home, and then we started dating again.
And then we got married.
And then we got married.
Yep. And now here we are.
Yep.
That's it, Michael. Questions?
Yep.
So we thought we'd talk some about kind of marriage and why would you get married and what's it about? And I think if you were to ask a lot of married people, how's your marriage going? I think the first thing in a lot of people's minds would be, am I happy? Is this marriage making me happy? I think if you were to ask a lot of people who are not married, it'd be kind of an interesting survey to do in SANC, why might you ever want to get married? The first thing that a lot of people would think about is something along the lines of, I'd like to be happy. And I think if I get married, that person might make me happy. Fairy tales very often end, you all know this, with a wedding. And the last line is, and they got married and lived happily ever after. Really? Is that all there is to it? Another disturbing thing about fairy tales for me, this is a little bit of a rant, but I noticed this growing up because I like to read a lot. In books, anybody remember who did Snow White marry? Prince Charming. Who did Cinderella marry? Prince Charming. Who did Sleeping Beauty marry? This guy had issues. It's like, as a kid, it's like, really? They all, the women are all unique, and but the guy is just the standard generic, you know, this guy's got problems.
I wonder if it was the same guy.
Well.
Could be.
Thank you for that point. That really drove it home. It's really interesting when you think about what do you look for in a person. The Bible never actually says, thou shalt find someone who will make thee truly happy. The Bible doesn't actually say that the purpose of marriage is to make me happy. And in fact, there is this odd truth that you will in fact never be happy if the ultimate goal of your life is to be happy. Happiness is kind of a byproduct when something else is going on. Some of you will have noticed this. You ever notice how people who fall in love will often use baby talk with each other? They don't do this in public, but there's a reason for this. C.S. Lewis, great Christian thinker, actually writes about this in a book of his called The Four Loves, when he's writing about romantic love. He says, the reason that people who are in love will often use baby talk with each other is because it is the tenderest form of language we have ever experienced. And the language of the earliest tenderness that we have ever known is recalled to do duty in this kind of love. Have you ever noticed how some people use baby talk with their pets? C.S. Lewis says this is stupid. Especially when it's done with cats.
It's true. It's true.
C.S. Lewis hated cats. Jesus hated cats. There are no cats in the Bible. You can look it up. There's not a single cat anywhere in the Bible. Sorry. Yeah. This is from a Christian thinker named Stanley Hauerwas. Destructive to marriage is the self-fulfillment ethic that assumes marriage and family are primarily institutions of personal fulfillment, necessary for us to become whole and happy. The assumption is there is someone just right for us to marry, and if we look closely enough, we will find the right person. This assumption overlooks a crucial aspect to marriage. It fails to appreciate the fact that we always marry the wrong person. We never know whom we marry. We just think we do. Or even if we first marry the right person, just give it a while, and he or she will change. For marriage, being the enormous thing that it is, means we are not the same person after we have entered it. The primary problem is learning how to love and care for the stranger to whom you find yourself married. Marriage is not primarily a vehicle for personal fulfillment. It's really about spiritual formation. It's a great laboratory, as is all of life, to be formed spiritually. And nobody gets married and lives happily ever after. Nancy and I were at a restaurant not too long ago. We were laughing about something, and an older woman came up who's part of our church, and she said, I saw you guys laughing with each other, and it was really fun to watch you enjoying each other. You must have a wonderful marriage. And Nancy immediately said, sometimes, because she just likes for truth to have a place at the table.
Depends on the day, yeah. So in light of spiritual formation being the primary purpose of marriage, we're going to look before the Q&A at just two simple things, that the call to marriage is a call to leave, and then it's also a call to unite. So in the call of leaving, it's about becoming a separate person from your family of origin. And for some of you, as soon as I say that, you think, that'd be great, because I left them a long time ago, and I'm really glad I did. For others of you, think, why would I need to do that? Everybody's on a different place in that continuum, and so much of our initial leaving is very unconscious. And part of this journey is bringing that to the level of consciousness and to be able to develop who you are as a person separate from whatever wonderful things your family may have given you and whatever wounds and brokenness you may have suffered at the hands of that family, which most families are very, very mixed. Part of leaving becomes growing in self-awareness of who you are and in the ability to be content with who you are. And being a content person is an incredibly great gift to give to a marriage. When John and I first started dating, and even into the first early years of our marriage, if you looked at us quickly from the outside looking in, it would look like John came from the perfect family, and it would look like I came from the broken family. And there was some definite truth in that. John's parents have been married for many, many years, three kids, very involved in church, very, very, very close, enmeshed, very close. My family, when I was a little girl, my parents split up for a year. They ended up getting back together, but my dad was an alcoholic. He was a very nice alcoholic, very functional. He wasn't mean, but there were those cycles of fighting and codependency, and probably even unconsciously, what I was looking for was the perfect family that I never had. And probably unconsciously, what John saw in me was an ability to save or help me because I came from that kind of family. Well, fast forward a few years into marriage, and we begin to uncover that the perfect family is deeply flawed, and the broken family gave me great strengths as well. And even to this day in our marriage, we can still see both the gifts and the scars that came from both of our families, and the same will be true of our children. One of them's married as the other two grow older, and if they find life partners, this will be part of their journey. But in the leaving, there becomes this lifelong journey of self-awareness and growing in contentment. In self-awareness, part of what happened before we got married is I had a chance to live with roommates. Roommates will give you a little taste of self-awareness. You think, yeah, I don't even need to go into much detail on that one, do I? Where initially you feel like you're seeing all the faults in someone else, and then you live with them long enough and you begin to realize it's not just them. Mm-hmm. That my perception of reality is so skewed by who I am and how I'm created. And this is where I think a lot of assessments can be really helpful tools in helping you understand yourself. I think in the category of a tool, over the last couple years, John and I have been participating in the Enneagram and the daily thought that comes in the email from the Enneagram Institute. It comes at 11 o'clock at night, and I tell people, don't open it at 11 o'clock at night. Just wait till the morning, wait till after you've had coffee. But it really is this impersonal tool that kind of goes after your deepest anxieties and fears that you didn't even know were there. And that becomes part of then not putting all the burden on your spouse to help shape and repair what's going on in you. But you take responsibility by becoming a very self-aware person. Another way that you know that you're growing in self-awareness is your defensiveness to critical feedback goes down instead of up. Instead of flaring when somebody criticizes you for something that way down in the very deepest parts of you, you know is true, but layered over all of it is such defense that all you can do is either attack the person or go find three other people that will salve your wounds and say, oh, they're just so terrible. Neither one of those is going to lead to growth. Michael mentioned, sounds like I do still have a job, the organization that I work with, and I have a chairman of our board who's one of the most competent people I've ever met. I'm guessing almost in every room he ever walks into, he's the smartest person in the room. He's very good as a leader in the areas of challenging and stretching and pointing out what's yet to be done. And that's really great stuff. And after 2 years of it, I'm not hearing any encouragement. I'm a little nervous to go in and tell the chairman of my board, who's the smartest person I think I've probably ever met, that I'm not feeling the love. Just feels a little wimpy. So we finished our last board meeting. The first thing he said when it was over in front of the whole board to me and my staff, You guys talked too much. You didn't use the board well. We didn't get a chance to interact. He was not wrong. He was absolutely right. But I knew at the next time we met one-on-one, I needed to find the courage inside of myself to say, I get it. That's true. Here's what I'm never getting from you. It took a lot of conversation with John. How do I say this? With some friends, getting up the courage. And when I did, do you know what he said to me? Yeah, I hear that a lot. How do you fight with somebody that admits that they're wrong at the very beginning of the conversation? It's no fun at all. But it was amazing to watch somebody who's so comfortable in their own skin. There wasn't a molecule of defensiveness. He said, yeah, I hear that a lot. I know I do the challenge piece much better. He said, I probably hear this at my company from HR 3 times a week. I said, 3 times a week? He said, oh, that's way down from what it used to be. So, such a great example of somebody who's gone on this journey of self-awareness. And when criticism or difficult feedback comes their way, they kind of lean forward and say, tell me more. Tell me more. Because there aren't many people in my life that will do that for me. I remember when John and I were first married, we did the laundromat thing because the little house we lived in Pasadena didn't have a washer dryer. It didn't have a refrigerator until the 1940s. They had to build a little porch on the cottage when they invented refrigerators. This was a very old house. And we were at the laundromat doing laundry, and we were sitting down waiting for a load to finish, and our neighbors started to walk in. And I just whispered something snarky under my breath to John about the husband. And it was kind of funny. And it was pretty true. And John just said, don't do that. What a gift. What a gift. A call to be my best self. So this journey of self-awareness is part of the leaving of my parents gave me this foundation, and now I've got to figure out who I am. And you guys are right in the middle of that journey. And then to be content. And I know this sounds cliche, but a content person is a great gift to a marriage where all the weight of my needs I don't place on my spouse. That whether things are in a particularly good place with my marriage or a rough place, whether external things are good or bad, I am constantly trying to find that center with God that is content. And I think the myth is that you can get there. I think the truth is that you can get there for 2 minutes, and then it goes away, and then you have to fight your way back to it. And then after a while, you wear the path enough that it's a little easier to get there more quickly, but it's never the kind of place where you live 24/7. And when you hear somebody tell you they do, don't believe them. They're lying. Yeah. So that's the leaving part that's really important.
I'll tell you a question that it took me a long time to learn the answer to. Partly because of the home that I grew up in, and like Nance, I think both of us have so much that we're so grateful for, the homes where we grew up, and had lots to learn. The harder part for me was I didn't know I had so much to learn. I thought I was much more mature than I actually was. And with my parents, the story was kind of always a love at first sight, and I had never had that experience, and so I can remember when I would ask my mom, how do you know when you're in love? How do you know? And the answer would always come back, you just know. Not even you know, you just know. And that ended up not being real helpful for me. What would have been really helpful to me was to hear, you have to become the world's leading expert on yourself. You have to become really aware of what do you value and what's your identity and what's the stuff you like and what do you not like? And what kind of person do you want to become? And how do you respond when you get criticized? And what do you do when things get difficult? And what's your view of commitment? And what do you think about recreational activity together? And what does growth look like for you? You have to come to know yourself so deeply, so better than anybody else does. And I just thought, I'll just know. And then a real deep part of self-awareness for me was coming to understand that different did not mean that I was better. And one of the real early conversations when I was with Nancy and we were sitting around the table, they were talking about tires, and Nancy said,
with my family.
At your family. I got a tire at the dealership today, and somebody else around the table said, "You got a tire at the dealership? I would never get a tire at the dealership. They charge you an arm and a leg for a tire. I'd get a tire at Shell." Somebody else said, "Shell, they have terrible tires. You couldn't give me a tire from them. I'd get it someplace else." And it went on like that. One afterwards, I said to Nancy, "What was that?
Like
excuse
this.
Me, I'm still going.
Yes,
hang on.
I know,
just hang on.
Always. You're stepping, always you're still
I know,
going.
But I'm in the middle of what I was
all
saying.
Right.
Afterwards, I said to her, "What was that fight about?" And she said, "What fight?" And I said, "The tire fight." And she said, "That wasn't a fight. That's just how we talk in our family." See, in my family growing up, in the unlikely event that I ever would have bought a tire, my mother would have said something like, "Oh, son, you bought a tire? We're so thrilled. You know, you raise kids. You try to teach them right from wrong. You never know how things are going to turn out. And now you bought a tire. Can we just take a picture? This is such a beautiful thing." It's a real different family and wonderful in lots of ways. But dealing with like conflict and distance and that kind of stuff, conversations that to other ears would have been very much like normal conversation to my ears sounded real different. Now,
that's it. Just the tone was not quite the way it was presented just now, but.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. So that's all the on the leaving side. On the leaving side, this is something real deep in the Bible. If you go back and look at Genesis and the creation narrative, because the whole notion of marriage is tied to all of that, there's a wonderful theologian named Neil Plantinga, and he says, what's happening in the book of Genesis in the creation narrative, God is taking chaos and making it functional, making it creating shalom, order and functionality and goodness. And the basic way he does that is he separates stuff and then he joins it together so that it can be more complex and more functional. So he separates the light from the darkness. By the way, if I do this periodically while I'm talking, I eat really healthily 6 days a week. Sunday, I just eat terrible food all day long. I cram as much of it in as I possibly can.
The kids
I
call
love
it crap
Sunday.
Day.
I live for Sunday. But what that means is about 8 o'clock at night, yeah. I'm just doing this all day long. So excuse me if I do it. Did I overshare?
No, but we got to be done with leaving and go on to uniting. You don't need to do the Genesis thing because we're running out of time.
Okay. God separates and joins together. Light and darkness, the sky from the earth. It's a beautiful, beautiful truth. The dry land
for
from the seas.
Sermon, maybe.
And then he separates the woman from the man and then joins them together. And Jesus says, what God has joined together, let not human beings put asunder. So leaving, Genesis says that a man, interestingly enough, in that culture, men didn't leave. A man shall leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two shall become one. So there's leaving, and then there is uniting.
Which you're doing.
Let me say a little bit about uniting. I think the main thing I'll say about uniting first, and then you can go on, is this. When we think about marriage, most often what we think about is intimacy. And intimacy can be a wonderful gift, but intimacy is not the same thing as love. And I think one of the ways in which I was just not prepared for marriage when we got married was I didn't know the difference between intimacy and love. Intimacy is shared experience. Intimacy will create a sensation of closeness and connection. That's a wonderful thing. Love is to will the good. And even at times when we are in conflict, even at times when it may not be like a Hallmark commercial or a Lifetime movie, even times when there's friction and there's stuff to work with, where the intimacy level might not be what Nancy would hope it would be or what I would hope it be, love is always possible. And over time, the practice of love will lead to intimacy in the way that the idolizing of intimacy does not lead to love. I have this wonderful little card on a table in my office, and it's a quote from Victor Hugo from Les Miserables, and it's a wonderful picture of what a relationship can be like. My coat and I live comfortably together. It has assumed all my wrinkles, does not hurt me anywhere, has molded itself on my deformities, and is complacent to all my movements. I only feel its presence because it keeps me warm. Old coats and old friends are the same thing. And on the back of the note in pen are four words, "You are my coat." And it's signed by my wife. And you may think she must be a wonderful person to be married to. And she is. Sometimes.
I would agree with that. I would agree with that. A couple other thoughts on uniting, and then we'll get to any questions you might have. When you think about where most of the money and the attention goes to when a couple gets married, and then you contrast that with the vows that you take, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, for better or for worse, as long as we both shall live. And the vast majority of the time and the money goes on the cake and the champagne and the dresses. And it's so disproportionate to the reality that those vows make that it's a setup for some really difficult things in the future. And then I think in uniting, there's this trifecta of things, of three things together that you offer each other that over time have the capacity to pull you into the kind of intimacy and love that John's talking about. And it's acceptance and admonishment and servanthood. Those three things. They don't get a lot of airtime in brides' magazines, but how do you accept somebody that over time you begin to realize is very different than you, even if you share a lot of similarities? You know this already with roommates or brothers and sisters. No matter how alike you are, no matter how much you love somebody, living with somebody over time will bring out the differences. How do you accept somebody who's not fully formed, who's a sinner just like you are? How do you offer acceptance? How do you bring in admonishment, like John did with that little snarky remark I made and has done hundreds of times since then, as a call to my best self? And then how do you serve each other? And in the beginning of a marriage, when it's just the two of you, I think it's a little easier. And over time, if children come along, it can be a little tougher. But what does it mean to really serve somebody? What does it really mean to pull back on all of my ambitions in life and make some margin and room in my life to serve my spouse? And what does that mean for him to do that for me and me to do that for him? What does that mean for our careers when there's children involved who absorb an enormous amount of time and energy? And what can often happen inadvertently and unconsciously, unless you have intentional and difficult conversations around the division of labor, is reflexively you will move to very traditional roles. Or whether the woman chooses to work or not, the preponderance of the home life falls 100% on her shoulders. And that is a perfect setup for resentment and frustration and children who only know their father in certain ways and not in all the ways that they can. Difficult conversations around servanthood have really become for John and I, especially when we were earlier married, kind of the heart of what shaped our marriage. I remember one night in bed, late at night, in the middle of young kids and raising them and all the energy that that entailed. And something I said that got us both laughing, I just said, "I want a wife. Where do I get a wife? This whole idea that there's somebody to do all this stuff for you, I would like one of those too." And what does it mean for us to partner, not divide and conquer, but to really partner in the raising of our children? And I think that set us up when the children did leave the home to be able to have more of a partnership in our marriage. Yeah.
I think that's it.
Yeah, we're done.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's great. Well, thanks both of you. Thank you for not firing me, John. We had a lot of great questions.
Can I just say, I love Michael Napstead. Don't you love having Michael to be here and doing what he does and his heart? And
thanks.
Really.
I slipped him a 20 when he was walking up here.
20 wouldn't
get
have
to work
that.
With Michael.
No, that was great.
Thanks, John. I appreciate that. It's a blessing hearing both of you, and I have a lot of both of you talking. I have a lot of really great questions, and a lot of them still coming in. So I'm just going to go through some of them. We have probably way too many questions for the time that we have, so feel free to answer as shortly or if you feel like you want to unpack something a little bit more. The first one is, if the aim is self-discovery and development, how should we consider marriage versus dating? Is one just an intensity of the other, or are they radically different?
Wow. Well, I'd say do you want to talk about this or shall I jump in? I'd say self-awareness, the purpose of marriage is oneness. The purpose of dating isn't oneness yet. The purpose of dating is often to get to know yourself better and get to know the other person better and to gain experience, relational experience. And so self-awareness isn't the purpose of marriage, but it's a foundation for marriage. It's necessary to be able to find a good person to be married to.
And dating will help that.
That's great.
Yep.
Next question. When did you know that you were in love enough with each other to leave your family of origin behind?
Shall I start?
May 31st. On the picnic at Lake Arrowhead.
Yeah. That's when I told Nancy that I loved her.
Yep.
And she said she loves back. And again, I would say I think it was different for both of us. For me, because of my family situation growing up, I just had this very kind of mythic view that you'll just know. And so it didn't fit that myth, and that was much harder for me. Because the only categories I really had in my mind were either fairy tale, like an old-time musical relationship, or catastrophe. And so the category I lacked was reality. And so that's
an important
category to lack. And so it was much harder for me to say, well, it's not that category. But then Nancy and I dated for a while, and then she moved back to Chicago, and she was dating another guy. And I found myself thinking, I don't like that she's dating that other guy. I don't want some other guy to end up with her. But do I just know? And so that journey of I'm actually going to have to use my mind and think about it was very hard because I wasn't prepared for it.
So the next question is the question that was asked perhaps the most, and it's about sex. Can you talk about sex before marriage? And this is a very packed question, but it's a question that I think a lot of us do have.
Yeah.
Can you talk about sex before marriage? Why or why not is it bad to have sex before marriage?
Sure. Nancy?
We're getting a window into their marriage right now.
Sure. So what I would say is if sex isn't the most intimate act there is, I'd love to hear what comes ahead of that. And if you don't reserve the most intimate physical act for a commitment that matches that, that says forever, that feels goofy to me. And it's so interesting to me that couples will have sex before they get married and not think twice about it, but they will labor over what china to pick out. It's so off kilter. I honestly remember in high school and college going to parties and watching my friends drink too much or smoke something too much and go in a back room together, come out 20 minutes later, and within 10 minutes he'd be flirting with somebody else. And I remember thinking, not going there. To give that part of myself away, and again, I'm not saying that can't be, like, that's not the unforgivable sin and you're not forever estranged from God, why would I give the most intimate act that I can give to a person away without somebody that says, I won't leave you?
Yeah. So with one of our kids, one of the talks that when you're a parent, you got to talk to your kids about sex. And you'd be surprised, sometimes kids don't actually want to have that conversation with their parents.
We were quite
shocked. I'm sure all of you loved it.
My parents they rented from Blockbuster an educational video on sex. And when we asked a question, they would just push play and leave. I still don't know what it is, John.
I'll get to the question in a minute, but one of my worst pastoral moments at our old church, we were doing a talk for married couples, and we were talking about sex and just tons of questions. And somebody asked, is it okay if you're a Christian if you get, like, sex manuals to help you? Oh, and so I was trying to say, I think that could be super helpful, but if you are inclined towards any addictive or compulsion issues around sexuality, you wouldn't want to get a manual that's illustrated with real human beings. So I said, you know, you'd want something that's more like it doesn't look like real people, like illustrated with like the VeggieTales. Just that thought of a sex manual with VeggieTale illustrations.
I wonder what children's ministry at that church was.
Yeah, it was really bad. So, this answer is only slightly better. I was having a talk about sexuality with one of our kids one time, and I used the only thing that was in the car, which were, are they corn nuts?
Yes.
Yeah, I hate corn nuts.
Yes.
And so I just got three corn nuts. So just picture, if you will, three corn nuts. But this is the best way that I know of to try to describe it.
It was the best way you knew at the time.
Yeah, yeah. This is after getting a PhD in clinical psychology. So one of them represents your emotional level in a relationship, and one of them represents physical relationship, dimension in a relationship, and one of them represents commitment in a relationship. And every relationship will have an emotional component and a physical component and a commitment component. And if you think about commitment, you know, you go through a series of stages. So at first there's no commitment at all, then there's interest. When I was going to school, you would find out what the girl's schedule was and show up after class like by magic, you're just there. And if she receives that well, it means either she's interested or she's a pretty dim bulb, either one of which is enough to encourage the average guy. And then it moves from there to a date, which is a formal expression of interest. And then, again, when we were that age, it was going steady, which is it becomes exclusive. And then it was getting engaged, which involves a promise. And then marriage, which is a permanent exclusive covenant or promise. And so the idea is, if you picture these three corn nuts, you want to keep them all roughly proportional to each other. In other words, the level of physical intimacy that's being expressed in a relationship ought to be in parallel with the level of commitment that is made. And I would say that the reason for the Bible's teaching is God made us as whole people, and sex is never just about nerves and tissues. It's about the mingling of souls. Because your soul is that which integrates all of you together, mind, body, emotions, will, and connects you with God and another person. And that notion of oneness, one flesh is, you know, what's there in the Genesis account. So I would say anytime physical intimacy outruns commitment, somebody's going to get hurt. And that's the reason for that. And I know I'm an old guy. We've been married 35 almost years.
But we weren't old when we got
No, we weren't.
We met.
Yeah.
It was hard. Difficult.
It's very difficult, and I understand it is. And I know, and you guys are living in an age where the sexualization of culture, the way the technology has impacted that, you're living in a level of challenge that's like totally different than us. Yep. I get that. Churches can get goofy about sexuality. Either they don't talk about it at all, or they talk about it as if it is this very charged issue that matters more than caring for the poor, or they get really odd guilt stuff about that. I get that. But I would say that the Bible's teaching is that ultimate physical intimacy is to be reserved for ultimate commitment, and that's done by promise. It's not about a piece of paper. It's done in a public setting, because when we make a promise and we're real serious about it, we actually want other people to know it and hold us accountable for it. And it is worth it, guys. It is worth seeking to honor God and be really wise with both your commitment and physical intimacy.
Thanks, you too.
Yeah.
Here's another question. I've thought a lot about dating and marriage with a non-Christian. What are your thoughts on this?
Real simple analogy, if you're going to build a house and you have two people building a house, it's really good to work from one set of blueprints. You know, if you're going to build one house and you have two different sets of blueprints, it just doesn't work. I'm not an architect, but from what I understand, not a good plan. And a friend of ours, Neil Warren, the guy that started eHarmony, if anybody's ever heard of eHarmony, he was actually knew us way back before we got married. And Neil has studied marriage intensely. So if you ever see him in one of those little commercials, it looks kind of goofy, he really knows what he's talking about. And he would talk sometimes about how we have these different expressions like birds of a feather flock together, but opposites attract. And he said, when it comes to marriage, the research is real clear. Every similarity is money in the bank. So with your values. In fact, this is so true. Remember him telling us, if your IQ, if you have two people and their IQ is more than one standard deviation apart, if it's more than 15 points apart, they're more likely to get divorced. It's just a matter of empirical fact. Every similarity is money in the bank. And when you think about your spiritual commitment, you know, if my ultimate devotion is to follow Jesus, and I'm married to somebody whose ultimate devotion is something else, it's just going to make it harder. So,
here's another question. What are your Enneatypes? How has knowing about your Enneagram helped your marriage? My husband and I, both sevens, that's right, so am I. Come on, Nancy's too. Husband and I have found tremendous insight into ourselves and others from the Enneagram.
Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah. And I think especially the Enneagram Thought for the Day, it's just really a great tool to kind of scrape down to the bedrock of your soul. I'm a seven. John's a three. We have one kid that's a three, one that's a five, one that's a four. Any parent that raises a female four should get combat pay. I'm just going to say that.
How many of you guys know what the Enneagram is?
Yeah.
Okay, so most of you don't. So it's a way of understanding kind of personality type, and its origins are a little murky. Some people say it goes all the way back to the seven deadly sins. Mm-hmm. There's nine
Plus
different
two.
Categories. Yeah. But it's part of what's interesting in it is you might know Strength Finders, and Strength Finders, a big emphasis there is focus on your strengths. Don't worry about your weaknesses. Really know your strengths. Enneagram is really just here's why you're such a jerk. And you have to look at what your weaknesses
yeah.
are. So
yeah.
A three is somebody who they want to achieve, and that can be a good thing, but I can live my life to impress people. I can try to constantly be fed by making people do this. And so I'll get that message once a day. And I would say 13 times out of 14, it's, why don't you stop being such a jerk and recognize there are other human beings on the planet and act as though they matter too. And
makes you really want to sign up for it, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. But it's wonderful. It's really helpful.
It really digs into your motivations, what motivates you.
Yeah.
It's not about your behavior. People could have similar behavior, but our motivations are all different. So it becomes an incredible spiritual formation tool.
So in a way, knowing your Enneagram is a way, and your spouse's Enneagram, your partner's, is a way to be able to be a better partner to them, knowing
Absolutely.
How they kind of tick and what they think.
And to, Richard Rohr has done some of the best writing on Enneagram, to use it not as an excuse for what you do, but for a way of understanding.
I like that.
Nancy's taught me a lot, too. I think it's great for if you're a couple that's dating with roommates. It gives you a way to talk about differences that is fun and not heavy and makes space for and honors the other person. But then you can understand and know stuff about that other person that otherwise it might bother you or create difficulties, but it's really hard to find words for.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
So we have time for one last question, and this was asked a few times by a few different people. What happened in the last 10 minutes of your first date?
So I woke up, which is one good thing, because then we got to experience the last 10 minutes together. But because it was a blind date, we were with another couple, and we ended the date at the house where John was living during his seminary years, and it overlooked the Rose Bowl, the Arroyo Grande down in L.A. It was a warm night. We watched fireworks down there, and then we came inside the house, and John and I were alone in the kitchen for 10 minutes. And we just kind of leaned over the counter and we're talking, and all of a sudden I saw smart and funny together, which is a deadly combination for me personally. And his eyes were wonderful, and he made me laugh. Like, laughter goes so far. Mm. After 34 years of marriage, he still makes me laugh, and I love that. So the smart, funny combination was a killer. Yeah.
What can I say? I got it nothing to add. Yeah. Yeah, there you go.
Oh, gosh, that's awesome. Well, can you join me in thanking John and Nancy for being here today?
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Well, can we have one of you pray for us, and then I'll just go over one or two quick things?
Yep.
All right.
Sure. I'd love to. A lot of times when we pray, we bow our heads and close our eyes. I had a guy who's super influential in my own spiritual life, Dallas Willard, taught philosophy at USC. And he said, actually, in Bible times and throughout history, most often, most human beings pray with their eyes open. He says, actually, closing your eyes and bowing your heads was kind of invented by Victorian Sunday school teachers to control little kids. And so I think sometimes it's a really good practice to pray with your eyes open. It's a good way to remember God is here with us all the time. And sometimes at a restaurant or with family or something is good. So if it's okay, let's just all keep our eyes open. Now, God, it's very moving as I look around this room. And I see these very eager young faces with so much of life before them. So much to learn and so much to do. And they all look just so wonderful to me. But I know there's people here that are hurting and carrying deep scars and wounds. I pray that you'd pour out great blessings on them. I pray that you would give them great wisdom as they navigate relationships. I pray that people who have been hurt, wounded in their bodies or their sexuality or by another person would find healing. Pray that this would be a community of great belonging. Pray that every young woman, young man here would walk with you real close, get to the end of their lives and look at a journey on this earth that has been wonderful with you. And I pray this for them in the name of our friend and Savior Jesus. Amen.
Amen. Well, we would love to continue this conversation. We have snacks after sanctuary out in the coffee bar. A bunch of us go to Dutch Goose, so you're invited to join the community and continue this conversation. Encourage you to sign up for fall retreat and come with us. It's not too late. We have scholarships to help. And we still will have sanctuary next Sunday, even though we're doing fall retreat. And we have our executive pastor of Regenerosity, Charlie Scanlon, teaching on next Sunday on redemption. So it's going to be a really great talk. So we invite you to come, and we'll see you next week.